The Shore Shame Podcast, shining a light to the nations.
Well, shalom once again, everyone. I'm Bill Cloud. Thank you for joining us today. We are continuing to discuss what we're calling Mystery Babylon. And if you've been joining us in the last several programs, we've spent a lot of time discussing what Babylon is. And by that, I mean more than just a place. We've really spent a lot of time emphasizing that more than a place, more than a country, more than a region, Babylon is representative of a mindset, a way of thinking. And that way of thinking is a mixed and mingled thinking. The problem with that is that the mixed way of thinking, the ideal of coexistence and tolerance, actually runs contrary to God's purposes. God tells His people to be a set-apart people, to come out from among them and to be separate. And so never in Scripture do we see the Creator compelling His people to coexist or to be tolerant of other ways of thinking to the degree that they would come alongside of that. So Babylon, as I've said many times now, is a mindset. It manifests in people, it manifests in nations, it manifests in places. But more than anything else, it's a mindset. The woman who rides the beast in Revelation 17, again, on her forehead, she has written mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. And I don't think that it is an accident that it's written on her forehead, because that's where the mind is. In Daniel chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar has the dream. Daniel tells him the meaning of the dream and tells him that of all those components of that image, that Nebuchadnezzar, Babylon, is the head of gold. And so the rest of those kingdoms that followed after Babylon, the Medes and the Persians, the Grecians, the Romans, and on down to the very end, all of those kingdoms that would have followed Babylon would have received and inherited certain aspects of what starts at the head. Because everything moves from the head and goes through the rest of the body. The head controls that body. And so the head in Nebuchadnezzar's image controls, influences, affects the rest of those kingdoms. Again, the Medes and Persians, the Grecians, the Romans, they had their unique qualities, but they all inherited certain aspects of Babylon. And again, that means that they would have incorporated this mixed and mingled way of thinking into their lifestyle. So all of that is important because in Nebuchadnezzar's image, the last part of that image, or the last kingdom that is represented in that image, is 2 feet with 10 toes, iron mingled with clay. And so seeing that it is also part of this image or this body, it also is going to inherit aspects of Babylon, because everything's going to start at the head and it's going to flow all the way through the body, all the way down to the feet. Now, the interpretation that Daniel gives of Nebuchadnezzar's dream tells us that this last kingdom, this kingdom, the feet, the 10 toes, this mixed and mingled kingdom, is the last kingdom before the Messianic age. And so now we want to go to the Scripture. I want to read to you from Daniel chapter 2, verse 34, as he discusses this particular kingdom. He says, "You watched while a stone was cut out without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay, and broke them into pieces." So what we see here then is this stone cut from a mountain without hands is representative of the Messianic kingdom. The Messiah, who is that stone cut from a mountain without hands. And so where does he strike? He strikes the image on its feet, the feet of iron and clay. This is the final kingdom of man before the Messianic age. So if we believe that we're living in the end of days, then we would begin to see, I believe, the formation or the tendencies toward this kingdom of iron and clay. Notice that it's two different components, really incompatible with one another, and nevertheless are trying to mix together. Now, collectively, these 2 feet, those 10 toes, representing 10 kings, is going to correspond with the 10 horns of the beast. And those 10 horns are 10 kings. And we can read about that, and we've talked about that. But we see that in Revelation chapter 13. You see that in Revelation chapter 17. So again, what Daniel sees in this last kingdom of man, he sees it as 2 feet, 10 toes, representing 10 kings. But John sees it later as being 10 horns on this 7-headed beast, and those 10 horns are also 10 kings. And in Daniel chapter 2, verse 44, he tells us that these 10 toes are 10 kings. So what we want to see as we begin this is that what John saw and what Daniel saw, even though they have a different perspective of it, even though they're describing it slightly differently, nonetheless, what we're seeing is the same thing. They're looking at it from different perspectives, but they're seeing the same thing because they're seeing what's going to befall the world at the end of days. And so we come to this conclusion. This last kingdom, the feet, the 10 toes, which represents the 10 kings, is the last kingdom of man. This is the kingdom of the beast. If you want to say this is the kingdom of the Antichrist, this is the one. This is the one that would correspond to what John talks about in Revelation chapter 17, verse 11, about after this seventh principality comes and only continues a short space, that following him, there's going to be an eighth king who is not of the seventh, but is of the seven. This eighth king is going to come. This would correspond to this last kingdom that's 2 feet, the 10 toes, iron mingled with clay. Now, an observation. Interesting to me that the last kingdom before the Messianic Age is going to be represented in Daniel's book by 2 feet, 10 toes. And why do I find that interesting? Because not only do you have toes on a feet or foot, but you also have a heel. And that's important because if you've been watching these programs, then you know we have in times past discussed the concept of Jacob or Yaakov really meaning hand on heel, because when he was born, his hand was on his brother Esau's heel. And I believe to prevent Esau's heel, because Esau is the adversary, he is preventing Esau's heel from crushing his head. Now we're going to go down a little trail here and we'll come back to our main point in just a moment, but stay with me. In Genesis 3, chapter 15, God puts enmity between the woman and between the serpent, between her seed and the serpent's seed, and says to the serpent, you will bruise his heel, that is the seed of the woman, but he is going to bruise your head, and that is with his heel. But from that time forward is my opinion, very strong one I might add, that the adversary has wanted to reverse that decision, meaning that he's wanted to take his heel, so to speak, and crush the head of the righteous seed. So when Esau, who God rejects, according to the prophet, because he loves Jacob, Esau's heel, as he's being born, is poised to come down on top of the head of Jacob. And had that heel come down on Jacob's head, what would have become of Israel? Presumably, there would have been no Israel. And so the baby, Jacob, as he's being born, has his hand on his brother's heel, I believe, once again, to keep that heel from crushing his head. That is indicative to me, anyway, that the adversary wants to take his heel. That is, working through people, working through nations, he wants to take his heel and to crush the head of the righteous seed. So it is not a surprise to me that the very last kingdom of man, the kingdom of the beast, the kingdom of the Antichrist, is personified in Daniel chapter 2 as being 2 feet with 10 toes, and that foot also has a heel. Because this is going to be his last attempt to try with the heel, so to speak, to stamp out the righteous seed, to crush God's people. That's exactly what the beast is going to attempt to do. And he's going to have some success at it. Let's read now in Revelation chapter 13, verse 7. This is what John says. It was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. So it's very alarming to see this, but he is going to be given a certain degree of success, if we can use that word, to make war against God's people. Now, I want to go ahead and interject this. We know that God never allows the adversary to do anything in order to destroy his people. Now, he has used the adversary through time or allowed the adversary in times past to pursue his agenda, but God has never allowed the adversary to destroy his people. He has used the adversary as a rod of chastening. Nebuchadnezzar, he says, is my servant, but he has never allowed the adversary to destroy his people. Anytime God has allowed this kind of oppression, it's always been to provoke his people to repentance and to bring them into a restored relationship with him. And so I'm saying that because I believe that's exactly what we have going on here. You know, we can talk about the world being judged for its wickedness, etc., but everything really is going to come back to this point. God is trying to get through to his people. So then, at the last day, the kingdom of the beast is going to be given certain power, certain authority to make war against God's people. And he's also going to have this authority over every tribe, nation, and tongue, it says. Now, another thing to see is in this kingdom that is feet, 10 toes, iron mixed with clay, that it is inherently a mixed kingdom. It's a mingled kingdom. And for several weeks now, we have been developing this idea that everything that's mixed, everything that's mingled, everything that embraces coexistence, that we can all come together as one in this global society, and you will take your belief, and we'll take this belief, and we'll take this belief, and we'll mix it all together. All of that is Babylonian. That stems from, it originates from Babylon. Babylon the Great is the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. When Babylon as a city was built, it was made of brick, which is something that is the epitome of mixture, clay and straw being mixed together into a uniform and identical building block. There's no unique elements to a brick. The first brick looks like the second brick and the 100th brick and on down the road. And that is what coexistence seeks to have. All of that stems from Babylon. And so we see that Babylonian element in this last kingdom of man. Let me read to you what Daniel has to say about this particular kingdom in Daniel chapter 2, beginning at verse 41. He says, "Whereas you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. Yet the strength of the iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay, the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. As you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay. And in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever." So, at the very close of those verses, we see, again, the Messianic kingdom, the kingdom of the Messiah, the return of Yeshua, who is King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And he will destroy all of man's kingdoms. There won't be anything left of it. And his kingdom will never have an end. But when does his kingdom come? It's in the time when this last kingdom of man is walking upon the earth, treading upon the earth, trampling down. And what we see in this last kingdom is that it will have elements of Rome, if you will. A lot of people believe that this last kingdom is a revived Roman Empire. I humbly disagree, although I would say it does have the elements of Rome in that it has the ferocity of the iron. It has the rigid components that the iron portrays. But it's interesting to point out here that Rome didn't just have one leg. It had two legs. There was a Western, and then there was an Eastern. And the Eastern far outlasted the Western. So we're not going to get into all of that, but just to say that yes, there is some elements of Rome in this last kingdom, but I would suggest to you there are also elements of the Grecian Empire. And there are also elements of the Medo-Persian Empire. And there are most certainly, and I think overwhelmingly, components of the Babylonian Empire. Because once again, everything emanates from the head. But not only does it have the the strength that the iron portrays, but it also has an inherent weakness, and that is it's mixed. It's mingled. And what it's mingled with, it says, is likened to potter's clay, which compared to iron is very fragile. So four times Daniel tells us that this last kingdom is a mixed and mingled kingdom. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the key to its weakness. It's the key to its weakness. And so then, if iron and clay do not mix, they try to mix them, but they do not mix, which one is eventually going to win out over the other? It's not going to be the potter's clay. It's going to be the iron. And so this kingdom, as it evolves and takes shape, here's what it's going to do. It's going to seduce people into mixing, into mingling, into tolerating, into coexisting, so that we can all come together for one great purpose. And this is something, ladies and gentlemen, that goes back to the time of Nimrod, that he deceived people with his words, wanting to bring these people on board and join him in his rebellion against God, not to pose as God, but to oppose the true God. But he deceived the world of that day with words and convinced them to come together and to build this city, fire brick, make this city, build a tower that reaches up into heaven, establish our authority, lest we be scattered abroad across the face of the earth. That's exactly what we see going on today. Kings of the earth are seducing people to be tolerant and coexist and come together in this global mindset. Well, that's how they're going to get people to get on board. But the strength of the iron portrays this, that will to get the people to coexist in this way will eventually be enforced on them. It will viciously and ferociously enforce its will on the entire earth. That is how I believe the beast is going to subjugate all nations, tribes, and tongues. Now, considering all that we've learned, I think I've already alluded to this, but we want to go back and say this again, that this last kingdom is going to contain elements of all the principalities that have come before it. And let's go through those principalities. These are the heads on the beast, remember. There is Egypt, that's one. There's Assyria, that's two. There's Babylon, that's three. There's the Medes and Persians, that's four. Then came the Grecians, that's five. Then came the Romans, that's six. Now there's a seventh head, and when that seventh one comes, John didn't know who it was. I won't pretend to know who it was. Maybe it is a revived Roman Empire. But when that seventh one comes, it only continues a short space, and then arises the kingdom of the beast. Perhaps, these 2 feet with the 10 toes is how that transition is made. How that seventh principality comes, but yet those 10 kings are eventually going to turn their power over to that 8th king who is the beast. All that is to say this, that all of these kingdoms, all of the elements and components of these kingdoms, I believe, are going to be inherent in this last kingdom. And as a whole, this beast, the 7-headed beast, as a whole, that beast represents the body of that adversary, that serpent of old. This is his body working in the earth. In Genesis chapter 3, verse 1, we're introduced to the Nahash, the serpent. It says, "Now the serpent was more cunning than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made." So we know, or should know, that this particular serpent in Genesis 3 is not an ordinary serpent. John refers to him as that serpent of old in Revelation chapter 12. And it says here that it says that the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. So again, the serpent of Genesis 3 is not just an ordinary serpent. And John validates that for us. And notice that in Genesis chapter 3, that serpent is called a beast. And notice that he's called cunning or shrewd. That is crafty and clever. because he's good at deceiving people. And so at the end of days, how is he going to deceive the whole world? My belief is by showing them something that looks good, tolerance, coexistence, mixing, mingling, coming together as one. That's how he's going to seduce the whole world. But here is his agenda: to counter, to undermine, and to corrupt God's purposes. Because if he can deceive the whole world and alienate a remnant who hold fast to God's ways and God's principles of being a set apart people, then he will influence all these other people that he's deceived to come against those who are the troublemakers, those who won't get with the program, those who are going to hold fast to these old, antiquated views. That's how I believe the adversary is going to make war against God's people and against the saints. Because his methodology from the very beginning is to take truth and to mix it with falsehood. And he deceives many people. That's the way he's always done it. And this is equivalent to sowing tares in the midst of the wheat. Of course, that's related to us in Matthew chapter 13 in the parable of the wheat and the tares. So all of these things, all these dots connect with one another. And we see how the adversary operates. Now, it's fascinating that of this last kingdom, here's what Daniel has to say. In chapter 2, verse 43, he says, "As you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay." Now, it says there that they will mingle with the seed of men. There are many commentators that say that this phrase in Daniel chapter 2 should be connected thematically to what we see in Genesis chapter 6, verse 2. What does Genesis 6, verse 2 say? It talks about how the sons of God saw the daughters of men, and they took wives for themselves of all whom they chose. That's when the sons of God, what represents what's holy, mingled with what was common or profane. And then all of this corruption ensued. And the result was, according to Genesis 6, verses 11 and 12, that not only were people corrupt, but the very earth was corrupt. And so all this mingling, all this coexistence, and all of this corruption is what led to the flood of Noah. That's what led to those days where God decided, "I'm going to destroy man from the face of the earth." And that's important, folks, because the Messiah said that the days of his coming would be like the days of Noah. Let's read what he has to say in Matthew chapter 24, beginning at verse 37. He says, "But as the days of Noah were, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered the ark and did not know until the flood came and took them all away, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be." And so what is he saying here? Well, on one level, he's saying that the days just before his coming that people are going to be going about their daily routines, not really paying attention to what's going on. But he's also hinting at something. He says that the days of his coming would be like the days of Noah, when men were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage. In Genesis chapter 6, describing the days of Noah, the only people mentioned marrying and giving in marriage is when the sons of God mix with the daughters of men. And so what is the Messiah hinting to us? That the days before his coming would be days when men are mixing and mingling, taking the holy and mingling it with profane, rendering all this corruption. We are now in a day and time when we are addressing whether or not it's legal for men to marry men, for women to marry women. According to God's laws, this was never to be. This is not lawful according to God. But yet, we live in a day and time when it's considered appropriate to ignore God's laws and to mix things together that were never intended to be mixed. This is exactly what Messiah was alluding to. It is a time when men are mixing the holy with the profane, the clean with the unclean. It is a time of coexistence, all in an attempt to undermine God's purposes, all in an attempt to oppose God's laws and statutes and instructions, and from the adversary's point of view, ultimately to try to destroy God's people. But it's also a time, Messiah said, that the people who are engaged in this, they're thinking it's good. It looks good. Like Eve saw the tree, that it was desirable to make one wise. It all looks good. It all seems noble. But it sucks them into a mindset that disables them from being able to understand what's going on around them. And they did not know until the flood came and swept them all away. These are the days that we're living in right now, folks. We're going to be continuing in this vein as we, next week, we begin to discuss the days of Noah and what that's really all about. I hope that you'll continue to join me. I hope that you're enjoying these programs. Hope to see you next week. I'm Bill Cloud. Shalom.
Like what you're hearing? Become a Bill Cloud Premium Partner to watch or listen to hundreds of hours of teachings and resources on demand. Go to BillCloud.com/subscribe to start watching today.